Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 131 with the title Fluency Forward. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Caroline Praveen. Caroline is the founder of the Fluency Forward Foundation. Yeah, it's not easy to say, is it? Fluency Forward Foundation, lots of F's in that. That promotes education in underprivileged areas of the world. And when I asked Caroline to describe her superpower, she said, it is her relentless advocacy in her dedication to improving lives and her unwavering commitment to positive change. Hello, Caroline. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe. It's glad to be here.
Excellent. And you've got a lot of F's in Fluency Forward Foundation, haven't you?
I do. It's not so fluent.
Excellent. So, Caroline, tell me more about Fluency Forward and what that means to you.
Yeah, so that's an organization that I started about a year ago, just based off of my own experiences and kind of my desire to make a change for the people that I know are experiencing the same thing that I've gone through. And right now, my efforts are kind of twofold. For one, it focuses on working with local immigrant and refugee children in Pittsburgh. These children are from like Afghanistan, Syria, the Congo, Venezuela. There's so many countries. And they've all come here just looking for a better life, but are currently confined to a more disadvantaged community. And right now I'm kind of just helping them with their English language skills and also helping them to appreciate their culture while also learning about those of their neighbors. And the other thing that I'm doing is I am raising money to promote education. So one of the more notable things I've done recently is I've hosted this fundraiser where I kind of promoted it as a cultural kind of event. And I had more than 200 attendees. We raised about $4,000. We had three sponsoring organizations. We showed up in the news. It was a really great time. And we donated all the profits to another NGO that donates the money to children in rural India.
That's fascinating. You said at the beginning there that you wanted to help people to overcome some of the challenges you'd faced yourself. Do you want to talk a bit more about to the listeners around the challenges, who you are, your background, and some of you obviously had to overcome some challenges. So what those in particular?
Yeah, of course. So I am from India. I was born there and my parents moved here to the United States with the kind of goal of creating a better life for myself and my brothers in terms of education and just opportunities in general. So we came here when I was pretty young, but I didn't have an amazing grasp of English at all. And once I started going into school, I kind of just shut down. I was a very confident kid in my native language, which is Malayalam, a South Indian language. But once I kind of transitioned to English, I just kind of lost all aspects of my personality and wouldn't ask anyone for help, wouldn't reach out to anyone. And that really affected me, not just academically, but socially and internally. So as a kid that can't connect with the classmates sitting right next to her, I really just struggled to kind of like myself and be happy with myself. And I think the biggest issue there is that there was no kind of like miracle for that. There was nothing that saved the day and made everyone accept me or made me extremely fluent very fast. It was kind of just, I had to deal with it. I had to spend a long time kind of perfecting my English. And from there, it just improved.
May I ask what age you moved to the US?
I came here. So essentially, I started schooling and started to truly learn English around five.
Around five. Okay, because your accent sounds typically American to me. You obviously acquired English at a very young age. Mm-hmm. So you're extremely fluent. I guess that comes from living in the country for a long time now. So you've grown up with it. What were the biggest challenges you found? I mean, you talked about your lack of self-confidence because you're obviously nervous about pronunciation. You have to double translate in your head. Your whole mind is, you can't dedicate your mind to your personality. You have to dedicate your mind to the translation. So how did that manifest itself? You know, you said you lost confidence. How did you find a way to regain that over that?
Yeah, so I mainly lost confidence in a lot of school and just extracurricular settings. I wasn't able to connect with anyone around me. And the way I kind of regained that is really just with time, which is the really unfortunate thing. And that's kind of the reason that I'm doing everything that I can today, because I did have to endure it for several years until I got this accent that we're talking about right now. And from there, it was kind of a switch, really. It just switched and no one was weird to me. No one was kind of disaccepting of me, and it just became a lot better.
You kind of went from an outsider with a broken English, non-native, if you like, accent to being an insider where you're fluent and your American twang, if you like, is the same as everybody else's.
Exactly. And that's why kind of on this inside now, I'm really hoping to kind of break that barrier and bring more of those outsiders in without all of those struggles.
You mentioned you're working with people from across the globe who are migrating to the US, from Afghan to places in Africa. What are the biggest challenges they face? Are they fleeing war zones and discrimination, effectively, or are they voluntarily migrating for better lives?
So the majority of the children that I work with are fleeing some kind of war. So a lot of them are from Afghanistan, Syria, and Congo, which are kind of war-driven countries right now. So first of all, you have to deal with kind of their traumatic experiences. A lot of them are very young, so it's not debilitating yet. But you have to first address that. And then you also have to address their developing English, as well as kind of teaching them to be able to accept other people from other countries.
Yeah, because we assume that all people who migrate or who are minorities are going to necessarily be friends with all the other people who migrate.
Exactly.
they're just a stranger to each other as anybody else. So they would have their own biases and hang-ups. Do they come with their families, or many of these come alone?
The most of them that I know do get to come with their families, but they're coming from a very underprivileged background. Despite having maybe some sort of wealth in their native country, they come here with little to no success, and they're living in more of these desolate places around Pennsylvania.
And I would assume, therefore, that the family itself are probably not great English speakers. The parents may not have a high competency in English, so the people you're working with effectively become the family translators, I guess, and the family breadwinners in some cases.
Yeah, actually, I remember one of the girls that we kind of talked to every once in a while, she was telling us about how she can't come to our session today because she needs to go to her little sister's doctor appointment. So I was asking her why she would need to go to her sister's doctor appointment, and because I wanted her to stay, of course. But she kind of explained that if she wasn't there, even though her English is broken, it is the least broken in her family. And in order for them to have any kind of successful appointment or schedule anything, she needed to be there.
Yeah, so that's another burden on a young person when they're trying to develop themselves through their childhood, enjoy, have fun, grow and learn. They have this pressure and burden of supporting the family from a translation point of view. And if you're in a big family, that could be a lot of people you're responsible mm-hmm. for.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. I suppose the other side to culture, it's the modern world is not just spoken language. There's also, we're very much email, text, WhatsApp, Snapchat, social media, online, IT. You've got to be quite tech savvy. I assume that many of the people that come these days maybe don't have advanced technology in the same way that you have every day in your life now. So you've got to overcome the spoken language, but also understand the nuances of online communication as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I think digital literacy is a really big problem that they have to face on top of everything that they're already enduring. As a nation and country and around the world, as we all kind of become more into digital literacy, and especially I think with the influx of COVID, I think we've all really kind of turned to our devices and really focus on internet communication. But if you're talking to these refugees who have just left a traumatic environment and are trying to even stay on their feet, digital literacy is not their biggest concern, which makes sense, of course, but it's definitely a disadvantage to them because there are so many opportunities online that they'll just never know about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose also combined with that, you've got, I use the word poverty. I don't mean to say people have no money. I'm just trying to say that they may not have money to invest in internet connectivity and tech. And
exactly.
They become, in a modern world, it can become very isolated if you're not in an online, you can't order food, you can't go to the cinema. All these things are booking online. You need money. Most of it is online cash now or electronic cash. So there's a whole load of literacy you need to develop beyond just the spoken language. And tech can help you, can't it? If you've got, with AI, we're talking about ChatGPT before we went live. You can take photographs now and translate menus on Google Translate. We'll take a photograph and live translate. You can live transcribe television or someone speaking to you. So there's a lot more technology now to help people overcome the short-term barrier, but they probably don't really help if you're trying to learn the language because they almost give you a shortcut rather than force you to have to learn the language.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in a way it can be good that we have these people kind of like originally or like inherently learning the language. But I also think like you said, it's a very isolating feeling to not be able to connect with, for example, a Facebook community of people from your same region natively. And I just think the isolation both geographically from everyone they've ever known and their isolation digitally, it just piles on.
How hard is it to stay culturally attached? You talked there about the distance between your family, who are probably extended family still in India. Mm-hmm. You want to keep in touch with grandparents or cousins and other people who are maybe not digitally connected. And it must be really, really hard to keep in touch and share your stories both ways.
Yeah, it is. And I think it really does affect the kind of relationships, which is horrible when you think about it. These are like my grandparents that I don't get to talk to as often. So when we try to talk to them, first of all, we have to use a different kind of phone service that will go overseas. Second of all, the connection is horrible. We're yelling into the phone, getting frustrated, just trying to explain little things that are going on in our lives, and the infrequency of it kind of makes it hard to speak freely, because if I'm talking about what happened in my day, I have to preface it with, oh, this is this activity that I'm doing. And I think just the fact that I don't get to see them and all these children don't get to see them is just horrible for the relationships in general.
Yeah, that must be really tough, because where you're living now, you just FaceTime, whatever, you Google Meet each other, whatever you do, and you can see each other whenever you need to. And when you've got a cultural difference in that way, it must be hard. But yeah, so the people that you help, and that's right from a young age, right from the your sort of age was 4, 5, 6 years old, all the way through to teenage and young adults, I guess.
Yeah, they are of every age I can imagine. Really, I think the youngest is probably 2, and I think the oldest is maybe 15, and we're all just kind of congregated in one area. We don't really have the ability to kind of separate based on age or anything. We just try to cater to everyone's needs based off of where they are kind of within their education.
People have said to me that English isn't a terribly easy language to learn for someone who's not a native speaker, because you tend to pick up a lot of the complexity of English just by absorbing it and being around people and getting the feel. To actually learn it as a second, third, or fourth, fifth language, it's extremely difficult. And I've heard people, a lot of people say that speaking English is a privilege that shouldn't be underestimated. How did you find it?
Yeah, I agree, honestly. Like, even in retrospect right now, the way that I'm able to just form sentences and we're having a conversation, certain complexities in it aren't there in other languages. A lot more things are straightforward in the different languages that I've learned, or maybe these refugees have learned. And just coupling that with an inability to actually learn English with learning a very hard language in itself has to be horrible. I know myself, and it does help that they're children, so you have that kind of cognitive ability to learn more easily. But then you have to think about the parents, you know, because they're in the same boat, but their brain is 25 years older.
Mm. So how do you find yourself now? Are you still translating in your head, or have you managed to flick the switch where you think in English now?
I've managed to flip the switch, fortunately, but it kind of affects me the other way around now. So now when I'm trying to speak in my native language, I have to think in English first, and it's a lot more broken, which is, I don't know, it really affects your kind of security in your own identity, because I started off with one language and was really glued to that one, and I use it to communicate with all of my family, but now it's kind of lost.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was talking to someone many years ago who was not a native English speaker, and I was asking them, they were very, very fluent. We agreed that the best way of telling is, if you have to do a mental arithmetic in your head, do you, which number set do you count in English or your native language? And you have to get to that point where you're so competent and you think in your language and you're not translating it. It must be really tough, because I've never had the need to learn another language in that detail.
Yeah, that's honestly true. I remember talking about something like that with my parents, who obviously came here around the same time as me. They still do think in our native language, and every time they speak, they do have to translate it. So I'm lucky, because I learned English at a young age, so it's kind of hardwired into my brain. But for them, it's just a constant battle trying to communicate with anyone in the workplace, in the grocery store, at the movie, just constantly having to translate in their head exactly what they want to say.
Yeah, you probably see them fighting for the words and trying to get the sentence structure. So do you have much support in the communities? You say you live in Pittsburgh and you deal with people all over, sort of outskirts of Pittsburgh, where the properties, I guess, and the environment is slightly cheaper to live, I guess, out of the city. Are there government resources helping people? I mean, I guess the immigrants must have come over, and you must have come over via some sort of government program.
Yeah. I think a lot of these refugees, at least because they are seeking asylum, they do come through certain governmental organizations, and there are some more in Pittsburgh. There's the Jewish Council, which doesn't necessarily focus on Jewish people, but they focus on immigrants and refugees in general. And I've been able to work with them. They do a lot, really. They will do everything from enroll your child in kindergarten, from help you to kind of file to get your citizenship. And I think without those kind of organizations, which I really hope to get there one day, but they're very funded, very like well secure organizations. I think without them, these refugees, these immigrants would actually be lost.
Yeah. I mean, being based in the UK, looking at what's going on in the news, the political climate in the US in some areas doesn't appear very welcoming to non-native Americans, for want of a better way of describing it. In its own right, what is a Native American? And we go back 200 years, it's not what we imagine today, is it? It's the indigenous population of America is completely different to the current population of America. So is it tricky to navigate that sort of political societal undercurrent of Native American feelings?
Yeah, honestly, it is. I think you make a really good point. We think of what the average American is, and it's not even the original American people. It's not the people from this continent, which says a lot. But I think right now, I at least haven't experienced too many kind of microaggressions or racism in general because, one, I don't have any kind of prevailing accent. And two, I think the way Asians are treated is a little bit more durable in some ways. I think it's definitely damaging. But I also think that if I were of a different ethnicity, I think my experience would be a lot more difficult.
I'm going to phrase it. This is not a very polite way of saying it, but you're a good immigrant. People, you're kind of, you're an exactly. acceptable view of an immigrant because your skin is, you're not Black American, you're mm-hmm. Asian American, which is a completely different sort of privilege, if you like.
Yeah, it's kind of the different facets of racism in general. You have this like good, for a lack of a better way to say it, like a good immigrant or someone that is kind of stereotyped for working hard or being in computer science or smelling, like those are all very damaging to my identity, but they are not life threatening. So I think I am kind of lucky in that way, where you have other people that are accused of so many worse things.
Yeah, because you said in the show notes, your aspiration is to be a doctor or follow a medical career, and your ethnicity gives you a positive bias because people would expect someone of Indian descent to be a doctor or be in that kind of, you almost have that positive, the positive bias, you know, help you in that respect, yeah. I guess. And your, I would say, perfect English with an American accent is also going to help you. I suppose then you end up in this, as you, I think you hinted to, this dilemma in your head around your culture versus your current status, and almost having to, I'm not saying deny who your mm-hmm. upbringing, but you have to ride the fast train, don't you, if you like, to take advantage of society.
Yeah, I do. I kind of have to override who I was in the beginning in order to be successful here, which it's amazing that I have the opportunity to be here and accomplish so much. I think that I would be nowhere where I am if it were not for the country that I live in. But it's also sad to think that in the process, I've had to kind of give up a part of myself.
Yeah. It is. It must be really frustrating. Because obviously we're talking about you. What's your experience of working with the people you're helping? Do they have similar dilemmas? Are they learning English in the same way you have and developing?
Yeah, I think they're honestly in a worse situation than I am. I was able to learn English through kindergarten and so on, but I had at least some kind of prior knowledge while I was in India because they did teach you a little bit. So although I was really struggling, I wasn't clueless. A lot of these students are completely clueless, but more than that, they come from a more disadvantaged background than I do. So coupled with a worse understanding of English and very limited resources to actually kind of combat that, I just think their experience is even worse, and I feel absolutely horrible. I'll talk with these children and they'll just tell me about different things that have been going on in their lives. Like, for example, there's this one boy that always comes up maybe 15 minutes earlier to help us set up. So he's 6 years old. He'll carry around the tables. He'll set up the chairs. He'll put down the snacks. He'll do everything just to help out, but mainly with the intention of being able to talk to me. And I really appreciate that a lot. And I think it's really important to build that kind of rapport with these different students because they have so many things to talk about. And some of them are not so good, and it's good that they kind of have an outlet to talk to.
Yeah, because you see a lot of this on the news, and I don't pretend to have an understanding about the everyday true lives and what's going on, just the news versions. But somewhere like Afghanistan, Taliban, how it's unsafe to be a young woman or even a woman of any age, and also a young child, a young adult, in a country that is so dominated by a religion that mm-hmm. prevents anybody but men really having any success or privilege in life. It must be really tough to live in that environment.
Yeah, and it has to be worse really kind of moving here and seeing that switch. I mean, it's freeing in a way, but like, for example, the Afghan children that I'm dealing with, the women, for example, they don't even believe themselves that they have the right to the education that I provide or the conversations that we have as a group.
Yeah, it reminds me in some respect around the book Handmaid's Tale or the film The Handmaid's Tale. Because mm-hmm. you get so indoctrinated around the parameters of your life. You could become socialized into this very narrow view of who you can be. And then coming to America where basically the American dream is you can be who you want to be, provided you fit exactly. the right box. Yeah, it's far more empowering than it is maybe coming from somebody's country.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of debilitating in a way to start from this horrible place of origin and come here. You have all these opportunities, but you don't even believe in yourself, really, that you deserve them or that you have the capacity to achieve anything.
But within the communities you're helping, is there visible role models? Are you able to show people succeeding in the environment? You know, because I don't know Pittsburgh specifically or the environment. I guess it's majority. Is it a white or a black kind of area? Is it?
It is. I would say it's a majority white area, but I would say that the kind of like dispersion of minorities is not lacking in any way. So it is nice to see certain kind of role models within just the sessions that we hold. So for example, there's this one girl who is a little bit older than most of them from, I think she's from the Congo or she's from Ghana. I couldn't tell you, but she has learned a lot. She's very smart naturally. So she's learned a lot from what we've talked about. And because she's gone through so much herself and she has that kind of sympathy, she does go out of her way to help everyone else that's kind of struggling. So in a way, I see myself in her.
Yeah. Because I talk to a lot of people around limiting beliefs and imposter syndrome. And this must have nothing compared with the limiting beliefs and imposter syndrome you and other people you're working with faced. It's hard to, I know how hard it is to overcome my own imposter syndrome about a number of things. It must be really hard to find that belief, because you have to kind of trust yourself, believe in yourself before anyone else will believe in you. Because it's really tough. And if you've got no anchor point of success, you can't even leverage success of your family, because your family are potentially worse off than you. So you've got no history. You've got no second generation or third generation or grandparents or people in this country that you can kind of call on. You really are starting from scratch, aren't you?
Yeah, and another way that kind of affects everything comes to schooling and kind of the college application system and the high school application system. Because, for example, I'm first generation in the United States. I know hardly nothing about the process of applying to college because I'm doing that right now. So we find ourselves asking, we're lucky to have a community. We find ourselves asking older people, how does financial aid work? How many colleges can I apply to through the common application? And so on and so forth. But it really stems down to the concept of having this community. I have a community to talk to about these kind of concerns, but these children don't necessarily have anyone that they can identify with.
Yeah, the only relatable experience I could use for my own life is I'm of a generation where my parents and my wife's parents are elderly now, and we're going through the process of sorting out care, nursing homes, end of life, and it's completely a territory that I've got no experience in. And the people I'm of the similar sort of age haven't been through it either, because their parents are probably maybe a little bit younger or haven't got to that point yet. So it is really hard navigating something where you've got nothing to hang your hat on, if you like, nothing to anchor on. and you have to pick it up as you go along. So it must be hugely challenging, I'd say, for you and the others you're helping to get that cultural awareness. That's kind of what it is, really, isn't it? It's the cultural awareness, mm-hmm. the stuff that people just know.
Yeah, I feel like there's some things that no matter what, you can't teach in a way, which is horrible when you think about it, but it stems down to the same problem that I dealt with. Once you're here long enough and you're kind of immersed long enough, you do have to deal with the issues for several years before not only that you learn English, but you pick up on all the little subtleties, you pick up on the sarcasm, the idioms, even the way we form sentences and the slang.
Yeah, a lot of it is culture based around television, films, media, as you say, casual social interaction at schools and colleges, whatever. You just kind of pick it up, don't you? You kind of know. I mean, if I was 17 years old again, living in the US, I'd have no idea about sororities, varsity, you know, college etiquette, you know, all this kind of, only what I see on the films. And I can, that's because that's completely detached to my view of my upbringing and schooling. You know, I can't even relate to the curriculum and the school structures of people in the UK because I'm 40 plus years out of school. So yeah, it's I can see the challenge there of trying to create that relatable identity with the culture you're trying to live in. When you ask someone to explain it, they go, "Well, it just is," because you kind of know it. It just is. You never thought about having to explain what that meant to somebody because you don't have an explanation. It's just something that exists.
Exactly.
There's no why, is there?
Yeah, and I think I'm lucky in a way to kind of know all of this now. But like you said, there's some things I just never even think about to talk about. And I think that just kind of stems from the kind of like national identity that I've had to kind of put myself into, like we said, become an insider. As an outsider, it's hard to see anything about that national identity and pick up on the little cues like the etiquette, for example.
But we live in a global economy now. We travel, we communicate online. The world has kind of shrunk a lot in the last 10, 15 years. COVID probably helped it shrink even further. We can now communicate by default with anybody anywhere in the world that has the right technology. But there's a feeling the world effectively is becoming more divided. We're becoming more parochial, more kind of protectionist, more isolated in our cultures, and more fearful of outsiders. So how can we think about becoming more connected in this global world and relating to different people's experiences better?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the more that we become connected as a world in general, it's just more and more opportunities for this kind of conflict. The closer you put people of different mindset and different background and of varying levels of stubbornness, the more you see this conflict and everything kind of blow up. I think the way to kind of combat that really has to be to target everyone's underlying mindset. The only reason that you see certain policies or certain acts of discrimination from organizations or even governments in general always stems down to someone's mindset or several people's mindset, which is a very hard thing to change. I think it's very difficult to tell someone, hey, what you're thinking is wrong, it's discriminatory, and it needs to change. It's kind of accusing in a way, and I think especially in America, to be told that what you are thinking is wrong is a very hard battle. And just once there's a way to kind of symbiotically repair that kind of mindset within a lot of people, you can start to see some kind of change.
Yeah, I often say that you can't confront privilege head on, and because what happens, people with privilege will just recoil, they'll get defensive, they'll shut down, dismissive, or start using whataboutery and just denying people's experience. So it's exhausting sometimes to have to do the constant education, the constant reminders, the subtle remembering to be quietish and not too loud, because if you're too loud, people react badly. And it's a real struggle trying to get your voice heard and to get change out of it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you want to be a, I think you said in the show notes, you want to be a doctor. So what sort of medicine do you want to study?
I honestly don't know what kind of medicine I want to study. I think once I go to medical school, experience the pain of medical school, first of all, but also go through the rotations and kind of just get a better understanding of what I'm dealing with, I would have a better understanding of what kind of field of medicine I'd want to go into. I just know in general that I do want to go into medicine because I always have, but recently also as I've begun this work to combat the health disparities that I've been seeing.
That's interesting, yeah. Health disparities, yeah, because again, privilege does lead to disparities in medication, education, and sanitization of the communities you live in. We saw it in COVID as well. So what sort of health inequities have you come across so far?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I've seen firsthand with the people that I'm working with has to be the lack of quality care for people from a different socioeconomic background. For example, one of the boys that comes to our sessions, he is actually the same student that will help us come set up in the morning. One day he came up to me and we were just talking as normal. I handed him a table, I think, to set up because he's kind of accustomed to that. But he kind of just looked up at me and kind of shook his head no in a way that kind of contradicted his general demeanor. He's a very lighthearted kind of character I've seen, and I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know that I'd see a ginormous abscess on his arm and another one on his teeth, and it just comes from the lack of access to healthcare in general, the lack of access to hygiene.
Yes, that's another factor as well, isn't it? And healthcare in the US isn't cheap either, is it?
No, not at all. It fully depends on what kind of the healthcare plan that you have and the insurance that you have, but it's very hard to get an insurance plan if you don't have an established credit score, you don't have an established source of income.
But as I mentioned, I'm a native English speaker. I've spoken English all my life. The only language, apart from a bit of French and a bit of German and some Spanish when on holiday. What? How would you kind of advise me to create environments where people have, if we call, use the expression broken English or English, developing English, where they're not as competent and confident in it? How can I best help somebody without putting too much pressure on them? What sort of techniques would you use?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And that's something I've thought about a long time, kind of bringing these native English speakers into the sphere of work I'm doing and just instilling a sense of empathy. I think, first of all, it does relate to empathy, which I can tell you have, which is great to start off with. But I think just like in an environment when you're dealing with someone who is kind of struggling to form their words, the biggest thing is not to be kind of demeaning in the way that you deal about it. A lot of people, they are trying their best, but if you're talking to a 30-year-old male and speaking to them like a child, their ego will be hurt. You have to kind of consider the fact that even though they aren't able to express themselves like a fully developed adult, they are a fully developed adult with the same thoughts and same feelings that you might have, just in a different language. So I think the biggest thing is not to kind of act like their children, talk in a very kind of demeaning way and just enunciate very slowly and put on this kind of baby voice. I think that's the most damaging thing someone can do. I think it's more important to just take your time, let them have their time, not really show any kind of judgment, but also not try to be so over-inclusive that it just becomes kind of humiliating.
There's a huge difference between how people can express and talk than how they listen and understand, isn't there? There's a huge gap there. So what you're saying there is if I try and overcompensate to help them, it's patronizing, it's unhelpful, because they're used to listening to people speaking English on television, shops, and around. The fact they haven't mastered the skill themselves to speak it doesn't mean they can't understand. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And it also goes back to kind of their field of expertise if they do have a job. So I've talked to a couple people that are in the field of science as immigrants and refugees. They have such an amazing understanding of what they're doing, and they can communicate that really well in English, better than you and I could probably. But once they start to talk about something that doesn't relate to work jargon or just like in general, you really see that switch in the capacity of their English.
But I think what you're saying there is, don't use childlike language, don't overpronunciate, don't be deliberately kind of assuming that they don't understand. Speak calmly, slowly, but not overly slowly. Mm-hmm. Give the person time to respond. And if they are struggling with their words when they're trying to speak back, do you allow them to continue? Do you offer help or suggest a word or wait for them to give you a cue?
Usually, I think they'll give you some kind of cue if they've thought about what word they're looking for a long time and they just haven't gotten anything. They'll kind of look to you, and I think you'll be able to tell. At that point, yeah, it's fine to help them out and just kind of offer different things that you might think they're looking for. But otherwise, I think the best thing is to let them take their time. They know what they want to say. They just don't have the words to form it. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with. So I think being patient and just taking the time to let them do their thing it really does a lot for them.
Yeah, because many people will start by apologizing that their English isn't very good. And I'm thinking, well, my Spanish or my German, my French or my whatever language you said at the beginning you speak, mine is non-existent. You know, yours is, your English is far better than my interpretation of your language. So yeah, it's, mm-hmm. But I suppose that's the human nature. You want to be better, and therefore you tend to apologize. But I think we need to encourage people to not apologize and be proud that they're actually succeeding in communicating, and I shouldn't judge them for that.
Exactly. And I feel bad because some of these people will apologize for their kind of broken English, but then they'll talk to you with everything being understandable. It's just slight differences in the grammar or the pronunciation, but they're still speaking in a way where you understand everything they're talking about.
Yeah, and I think we can be quite bad at active listening, can't we, as a human species? Yeah. So I think it's also incumbent upon me as the listener to actually give that person attention, give them eye contact, smile, encourage them, show understanding, and say, actually, I missed that. Did you mean this? So you can always repeat. And they go, yeah, that's exactly what I said. And yeah, I think it's just, it's good communication as well, but we get quite lazy.
Yeah.
Assuming people understand each other. It's like, oh, just too difficult for me. Again, privilege, we're just pushing it back, aren't we? And putting the burden.
Absolutely.
It must be quite inspiring for you to see people who are coming together in the community you help from different backgrounds, different native languages, all speaking, communicating in English and growing in the culture in Pittsburgh in America, and starting to become part of the new America, if you like, and growing into that. It must be really, really inspiring for you.
Yeah, it makes me feel like I've actually accomplished something and I'm actually making a difference in essentially the lives of the children that I was just maybe 10 years ago. So I think that I'm really grateful when I see these kind of children developing, that I've leveraged my own experiences and my own struggles to take the burden off of someone else.
And it's, as you're saying, it's not just the children, it's their entire families and
right.
The next generation. So you are building a new life for these people through, or enabling their new life through what you're doing for them.
Yeah, and a lot of these people have been almost eternally grateful to me and the people that I work with that have helped them. Like the parents, for example, I am a teenage girl, but they are so indebted to me and the work that I've done for them. They regard me as someone that they can go to for advice and for consolation. And I'm really happy to be that outlet or that source of comfort for someone that's not even my own age.
Yeah. Where's the world going, do you think? Are we going to become more united, or are we going to end up in more division for a while?
Honestly, I want to say that we'll become more united, but I think the way things are looking right now, at least, it's not looking very promising. I think the more that nations get into contact with each other, or the more that globalization becomes more prevalent and you see this influx of immigration, it's always been a kind of negative reaction. But I think that with time and just getting used to it, at least, I think that it can become a more inclusive environment. It's just right now with, for example, all of the different racial protests that have been going on in the United States for the past couple of years during COVID, and I think a little bit after that, I think the United States and a lot of other countries that accept a lot of refugees or people seeking asylum are in a really tense kind of state, because they have to consider themselves as a nation, but also consider these people that are just looking to better themselves. So is it similar of an environment in the UK, would you think?
I'm probably not best placed to be an authority on that, but yeah, I guess what happens is you end up with something happens, and then there's acceptance, acceptance, acceptance. And then you get to a point where the incumbent people push back, saying the minority is getting too much time now. They're getting too much attention, getting too much investment. What about me? Then everything gets pulled back a bit, and then you have to grow back again. So it's almost like a step. You go forward a bit, back a little bit, forward a bit, back a little bit. And I think, and that's frustrating. You know, you don't want to wait 20 years. 30 years, 40 years. I mean, women, as a woman, I don't want to wait 70 years for equity in the workplace, or equity in the world. As a minority, you want a voice now. And I think whatever we do will never be quick enough for people who are marginalized or voiceless or unheard. And it will always be too quick for people who have the privilege or don't embrace change. And I think it's trying to find the right speed where we alleviate frustration, and we also prevent people becoming threatened and feeling challenged. But I'd like to think, you know, I'm assuming your generation, Gen Z, you're that young. We're seeing an emerging generation now where inclusion is more default. I don't want to generalize. I appreciate not everybody has that view. But whether it's your sexuality, your gender, your ethnicity, your beliefs, whatever they may be, people, in my opinion, seem, as a Gen Z, more open to that kind of natural state. So maybe we need your children to be the first generation of people who grew up in a world where change has already occurred. You're still in an environment where you're wanting change to occur. Hopefully your generation can create that change that the next generation, the Gen Alphas and the Gen Betas, will face when they come through.
Yeah, I agree. I think the environment that a lot of people in Gen Z have been raised in has been more inclusive inherently, and that's been amazing, really. I think that's absolutely true. The way that people in Gen Z kind of view, for example, mental health, they actually view that as a valid concern. They prioritize that in a lot of instances, whereas someone that's older and maybe more closed-minded might not actually think of that, because that wasn't really a prevailing issue or a topic of conversation when they were growing up. So I would fully agree. I think as we grow as a generation, and then the generation after us also grows in this more inclusive environment, there will definitely be more room for inclusivity.
Yeah, let's hope and well, pray that. I often say that I don't know if you've ever seen the video. It's by Accenture, and it's called Inclusion Starts With I. If not, check it on YouTube. And one of the messages that comes out of that for me is that, you know, inclusion starts with me, with I. And you may not be able to change the world on your own. You may not be able to influence everybody. But as it says, you can be the one. You can take responsibility for changing who you are, for how you show up, how you communicate, how you're inclusive, the empathy you show for others. And hopefully you become an influence on those around you. So I would think, yeah, change yourself. Be the person that brings that change. Be the person that can influence, and keep holding the rope. You haven't got to pull the rope. Just hold it. Just hold the rope as an ally, as an advocate, whatever it may be, and just keep nudging the world and keep nudging it. I think if we all did that slowly, then that would spread like COVID. It would infect everybody. That's what we want. We kind of want. we want this modern thinking to be a better of a world to be a better place, and it's not all capitalism and exclusion. It's trying to find that happy harmony, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it always does just go back to our individual mindsets and just the belief that in order for change to be incited, that everyone has to do something simultaneously, which is just not at all true, but that's a belief that I know a lot of people hold. You're absolutely right. As long as you are doing something to impact the way that you're acting and just influence your mindset, your kind of discriminatory kind of like background or any kind of beliefs that you might have personally, you are making a substantial difference in the environment for these people that are looking for some kind of inclusion.
The planet's a big deal at the moment, isn't it, as well? It's not just the people, it's the planet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the world, the climate, sustainability. And again, you look at what's going on in some of the developed countries. Well, that's a horrible word, developed countries. What does that mean? The polluting countries or the countries, the industrial nations that are polluting. And we're seeing India, China, Russia, Soviet, even the US now, ignoring climate change targets. We're seeing world temperatures rise. We're seeing a pushback on belief that the climate's an issue. And I'm very mindful that I'm talking to you as a young person. This is your planet. And it must be extremely frustrating to see what my generation before have done to it. And we're not leaving it in the best place, are we?
Exactly. I think it kind of goes back to that kind of stubbornness that a lot of people have, even as a nation, kind of denying the existence or the prevalence of this climate change and the effect that pollution is having on the environment, just because it benefits them as a nation in terms of profit or appearance in general.
Yeah, as you were talking then, I was just thinking that in the same way you and people in your community have had to travel the world to come and find a new home in America and the US and then learn about the cultural differences and the language and all this. I'm in the same position as a Gen X person to learning about the modern culture of climate and planet protection. I don't know the lingo. I don't know how it works. You know, yes, I'm thinking about electric cars. I'm thinking about renewables. I have to think twice about, can I recycle this? You probably just pick it up and go, stick it in the green one. It's fine. Yeah. Stick it in the brown one. And I'm trying to look at the packaging. I'm still trying to interpret because I'm not a native climate person. Yeah. So I'm having to translate my interpretation of this as well. So that gives me a perspective on what it's like having to relearn the environment I live in. And that's the barrier that people are reluctant to relearn, to pick up the new lingo, to pick up the new culture, to pick up the new understanding. They're so fixed in their mindset, they're sticking with what they know. And I think you and your communities that you're working with have had change as part of your lives inherently for as long as you can remember. And maybe one day you'll become ingrained in 20 or 30 years' time and the next generation, the Gen C's or Gen F's or whatever they will be, will come along and go, God, you're all stuck in old ways of thinking. You're going, hang on a minute, how did I get old? How did I forget?
Yeah, it definitely is kind of cyclical in a way. But like you said, like you're able to relate it to the concept of climate change and kind of imagining the kind of issue that other people deal with. I think it always just goes back to the concept of sympathy. A lot of people, regardless of what generation they're in or what age they are, some people do have sympathy. Some people don't. And you still see this within my generation. So I think as long as the almost like the ratio of the amount of people that are willing to understand what's going on in the world, how the world is changing, and not just stick to their mindset and their point of view, I think that we're on a good track.
I like that. It's the ratio. So yeah. Taking my be the one saying, it's about tipping the ratio, isn't it? It's about... Yeah. Keep nudging it and eventually the scales will tip. That's what we're looking for here, isn't it?
Exactly, keep nudging one by one.
Focus on the ratio. Yeah. One at a time. Yeah, no, I like that. It's really good. Caroline, it's been a fascinating conversation. I've loved chatting to you. And I don't want to be patronizing, but you tracked me down. You Googled me, you found me, you applied, and now you're here. I think it's amazing. You know, as a young person, you've got such a great command of English with your accent. You've obviously achieved a lot. You're doing a lot in your communities. And I've got so much hope for you and desires for you to succeed in whatever you choose to do, whether it's in medicine or carrying on in what you're doing now. You're going to be incredible. And I wish you every success. So how can people get hold of you?
The biggest thing that they can do is visit my website, the fluencyforwardfoundation.org, where I have a lot of opportunities for online volunteering or actually in-person sessions that I conduct with these immigrants and refugees. And the other thing that anyone can do really is reach out on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn is just my name, Caroline Praveen. And I've received a lot of kind of business inquiries that way. And just being able to have that kind of conversation one-on-one with anyone about the kind of work that I'm doing and the kind of work that they want to be involved in has been life-changing for a lot of people that I've talked to.
Caroline, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for being so open-minded to kind of understanding the plight of someone completely different from you. I think it's people like you that are actually helping to make this positive change that I'm so desperately working towards.
Thank you. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.